Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Until there's a vaccine. We hear that phrase so much nowadays as people around the world yearn for an end to the pandemic. And dozens of vaccines are currently in the works. But even when one does become widely available, then what? Health experts say this much-anticipated development is not an instant get-out-of-jail-free card. Today in The Exchange, the COVID vaccine, how it would be made and distributed, and who could get it first among the world's 8 billion people. Exchange listeners, what questions or concerns do you have about this? Give us a call at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can use Facebook or you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Kendall Hoyt. She's an assistant professor of medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine and a lecturer at the Thayer School of Engineering. Also Matthew Fox, professor of epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health, and Anne Sossen, program director at the Center for Global Health Equity at Dartmouth. And all of you, a big welcome. And my first question is, why does everybody involved in this vaccine issue say this is not an instant back to normal? Matt, it's not the get out of jail free card that everybody is desperately hoping for. Why not, Matt?
Unfortunately, it's not. I'm sure all your listeners are hoping that we will have a vaccine that is announced shortly that is a nice effective vaccine and that we can shortly after that all go back to life as usual. But unfortunately, there are some steps that would have to be taken and some reasons why that might not actualize the way that we really hope. And there are two main reasons for that. The first is just that it will take time. So we've never in our history ever developed and scaled up a vaccine in as short a time as we are hoping to do this for the coronavirus. And that just means that we are working on a time frame that we've never really actually implemented before. And so there are just some facets of the process that need to be implemented in order to scale up production of a vaccine. So as soon as a vaccine is developed, we'll need to scale up production. Fortunately, there are steps that are being taken as we speak that'll help speed that process along, but still it takes time to scale up a vaccine that is going to be enough for the entire world to be able to have access. The second reason is we don't know yet what that vaccine is going to look like. People are more and more confident that we will have a vaccine, but having a vaccine doesn't mean that it will be 100% effective. And so if we have a vaccine that is, say, 60% effective, that means that even if everybody were to be able to have access who wanted it, or if everyone actually were to take the vaccine, still not everyone would be protective. And that would mean that the vaccine would be, that the virus would continue to circulate. So there are a number of hurdles we'd have to get over. And until then, I think we still need to think of this as one of the tools in the toolkit to fighting the coronavirus.
Interesting. So one tool in the toolkit, the other tools, Matt, being a continuation of this painful social distancing that we're all under.
Yeah, maintaining social distancing, continuing to wear masks and minimizing social contact, washing hands, all of the things that we have been doing our best to do to try to minimize transmission over the past few months, you know, they won't be quite as essential because you will have less transmission once a vaccine starts to be rolled out, but we'll still need to be continuing those until, you know, transmission really stops.
What do we know, Matt? And there's so many vaccines under production. I was looking at a long list today, and they go at it differently, different types of processes to tackle this and create immunity. But what do we know at this point about how protective a vaccine might be? You know, are people looking at vaccines that will offer immunity for life, like the smallpox vaccine?
or are companies looking more at, you know, vaccines that offer limited and uncertain immunity, like the annual flu vaccine? I mean, what's the spectrum here?
Yeah, the answer is we don't really know. And part of that has to do with the fact that we are we don't have any data yet conclusively to tell us how effective these vaccines would be, let alone long-term data to tell us whether or not these vaccines would lead to long-term immunity. So the data that we have so far comes from really phase one and phase two trials. And those are trials that are really small trials that look at whether or not the dosing that we're giving people is the right dosing to be able to give people in order for it to be tolerated. But we're not really looking at the efficacy yet. And therefore, we just don't have that information. It certainly is theoretically possible that we get a vaccine that confers long-term immunity, but my suspicion is we will get something that'll be much more akin to a flu vaccine that would really need to be continually developed in order to make sure that it is most effective.
Wow. Okay. So flu vaccine, I mean, people get that every year. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. That makes me less excited, Matt, I gotta say.
Well, I think, you know, again, think of this as in comparison to the flu. When we have a reasonably effective flu vaccine, you know, that's somewhere, you know, that could be in the neighborhood of 50% effective, and yet we all then go about our lives. So even a 50% effective vaccine, if people were to uptake that vaccine, it would do enormous work towards allowing us to go back to normal. It's just that we would continue to need additional efforts in order to get ourselves to a place where we could go back to life completely as normal.
Well, and Kendall, how about you? Why do most people say, even if a vaccine, an effective vaccine, as Matt says, were announced tomorrow, you know, that's not flipping the switch on life as we all knew it in February, Kendall?
Right. Well, a lot of it has to do with manufacturing and our capacity constraints. So, you know, estimates show that global capacity at its maximum in the near term, saying, you know, by the end of 2021 is about 2 billion doses. That's, you know, and maybe you need two doses, and there are approximately, you know, 7.8 billion people in the world. So, and it takes, you know, 3 years to build, you know, at a minimum, to build new manufacturing capacity. So there will be supply constraints, you know, even if the vaccine is 100% effective with sterilizing immunity, there's still supply constraints. So the time, it won't be immediate. It will be eventual.
What does this manufacturing capacity look like right now, Kendall, in terms of, you know, where it's located and who's doing it?
It is distributed around the world, which is an important fact to digest because, yeah, you know, things like Operation Warp Speed talk about an American vaccine, and that is incoherent. That's not how vaccines are made. So a lot of the capacity really resides with, you know, multinational pharmaceutical companies like GlaxoSmithKline, Merck, Pfizer, you know, a lot of the names that you're seeing for some of these big contracts, but they're distributed and they contract out for additional manufacturing, and it is all over the world.
You said manufacturing capacity right now, Kendall, correct me if I'm wrong, is it 2 billion doses? Is that right? Did I understand you right?
That's
there?
That's approximately right, yes.
Yeah, so what's it going to take to scale up to 8 billion, understanding that not everyone in the world is going to want this vaccine, and we'll definitely talk about that later, but what would it take, Kendall, to get up to 8 billion?
It's going to require building new capacity, much of which is we're investing in right now. So it's called, you know, manufacturing at risk. So you're building the capacity and you're going to start to manufacture before you actually have the results from phase three efficacy trials. So you might, you know, you're taking a bet and it's part of a, you know, Herculean effort to get the maximum possible number of doses in the shortest possible amount of time. But still, as I said, that number is fixed pretty much at 2 billion right now, with the potential to scale once we expand our build new capacity over time.
Ann Sossen, I'd love your expertise on this as well. Again, you're at the Center for Global Health Equity at Dartmouth, especially around this question of why isn't this the instant cure, the instant fix that everybody is looking for?
Sure. So as Matt and Kendall have noted, having a vaccine in hand doesn't represent a vaccination. And that first vaccination, while representing an important scientific and really political milestone, doesn't herald an end to the pandemic. To get there, we're going to need to vaccinate what we think is an estimated 70% of the world's population. And once we have that vaccine, we'll need to have systems in place to distribute it globally. We'll need to have systems in place to deliver and administer those vaccines. And we can anticipate a range of challenges at every point along the way.
Wow. Give us a little taste of some of those challenges in that range that you mentioned, Ann.
So we have systems in place to deliver vaccine, but not at the scale that we will need to have them in place right now. We also know that we'll need to think about how that vaccine is delivered within our health systems, as well as within our communities, both in the US and globally. Once we have the vaccine in place, we can anticipate a range of challenges in ensuring uptake of the vaccine as well.
Uptake means people deciding, no, I'm not going to do this. Is that what you mean?
Right. It just having that product available doesn't mean that people will come to get vaccinated or that they won't encounter barriers in accessing that vaccine.
What past examples, Ann, are you thinking about these days where a vaccine was definitely helpful, but didn't signal an instant switch to, again, life as we knew it? Are there other examples that you're looking at lately, Ann?
So this is really, in many ways, an unprecedented situation. We haven't faced a global pandemic, but there are other cases that we can look at both globally and domestically as we think about some of the challenges that we will encounter. As I think about the global situation and how vaccines and other biomedical technologies are distributed, I'm really reminded of the case of antiretroviral therapy that was available in the United States in 1996, but it wasn't until 2003 that was available globally. And that took a movement of scientists, of physicians, of activists across the world to come together and to make that vaccine available globally. And we can anticipate that there will need to be similar efforts to ensure global access to that.
Wow. Matt, I'm interested in what you have to say about that too. Just past pandemics, or at least epidemics, that you think are instructive for this time, recognizing, as everybody has said, this is unprecedented. But what are you looking at, Matt?
Well, it absolutely is unprecedented, and therefore we don't have a model to go with. I do think that the HIV epidemic is one that we look at, but I think we can also think about some of the decisions that need to be made around other areas where we've had vaccines that have not been fully effective. So one example of that would be a malaria vaccine. There have been various malaria vaccines that have been developed that haven't been highly effective. And there are decisions that need to be made around just how effective a vaccine would have to be before it would be worth the cost and the effort to roll it out. Because, you know, you do have the problem that if you roll out a vaccine that only has, you know, very, very low efficacy, say 30%, you're going to have a lot of people who will get vaccinated who, you know, run some maybe small risk of complications, but more than that, may think that they're protected when in fact they have only a small chance of being protective, and so they change their behavior. So we really need to think very carefully about what level of efficacy we're willing to accept to roll out in order for that to be one of those tools in the toolkit that we talked about.
Wow. How about you, Kendall? What past examples are you looking at these days?
I'm sorry, of Which specifically?
Past examples of sort of epidemics or pandemics or major outbreaks where, you know, there were examples around how the vaccine was produced or distributed that you might think would be helpful this time around.
Yeah, the 1976 swine flu affair was pretty interesting in that we decided in a very short period of time to vaccinate the entire U.S. population based on, you know, scant evidence that there was going to be a pandemic. And it was interesting because the federal government was able to encourage private manufacturers to produce enough to vaccinate every U.S. citizen at no profit, which was a remarkable achievement. The problem was the pandemic did not materialize, and B, we had some early signs of potential negative side effects, which derailed the entire campaign and actually, you know, affected the private vaccine industry as a consequence. A lot of companies started to divest from vaccine development divisions. So that had a negative impact over time, even though from a policy perspective, it was a triumph, you know, in trying to achieve stated objectives.
Wow, that's really interesting. And I had forgotten about that example. So how, Kendall, does that stick with us today, that example that you just gave from the 1970s?
Well, I think it puts a premium on, you know, a lot of our communication campaigns coming out, particularly today when there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy that's inherent from, you know, sort of the anti-vaccination movement, but also people who aren't anti-vaccinationists are concerned given the speed at which we've been working to produce this vaccine. And I would say it would be compounded if this was a vaccine that rolled out prior to the election, people would wonder. And so we need to be incredibly transparent about phase three results and the decision process. And, you know, getting, you know, scientific experts out there really discussing this in detail so people can understand what this vaccine is and get comfortable with it. And we also need a campaign. So, I mean, another interesting example from history, you know, when we had the polio vaccine, people, you know, teenagers were not taking the polio vaccine. It was like 0.6%. And then Elvis Presley went on the Ed Sullivan Show and got vaccinated, and teen uptake increased by 80%.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, there's value in taking, you know, whether it's a trusted scientific expert or community member or rock star, what have you, you know, let's get Lady Gaga vaccinated on, you know, the Tonight Show.
Well, conversely, Kendall, you know, someone very famous, especially among younger people on social media, could say, don't do this, and scare large numbers of people.
Yep, that is a risk.
Well, speaking of safety and the speed at which these vaccines are being developed, got an email from David who says, with vaccines being developed and rushed into production and used at warp speed, David says there simply won't be enough time to determine through testing the intermediate and long-term side effects. And David says, I'm not aware of any software simulations sophisticated enough to give reliable answers about these vaccine safety. David says, what are the actual risks involved with this truncated process? And Matt, what do you think? You mentioned earlier, this is unprecedented, the speed at which vaccines are being developed. So what comes up around safety?
It is. We are moving at a speed that we've never moved before. And that is inevitably a trade-off between speed and having the complete picture. We never have the complete picture when a vaccine is rolled out because they are newly developed and we need time to see what the long-term consequences and side effects are. Now, usually those long-term side effects that we don't know about tend to be rare, but they can be quite severe. And therefore, we do need time to make sure that we know what those are. When it comes to the phase three trial, so those are the trials that will happen once we have the correct dosing. We move into phase three trials where we look for how effective is this vaccine. And those involve thousands of people. And so we usually get enough people to get a good sense for what the short-term side effects are. But it, as I say, it doesn't tell us about those long-term side effects. And so we need really careful vigilance to ensure that we are on the lookout for those over time. But I think the emailer is correct that we won't know all of those things right away. And so we really are dealing with the trade-off between what do we do in a situation where there is large-scale mortality happening and we need something quickly, and you know, the desire to know all that we could know before we roll things out.
And anything to add there? Concerns about the speed with which this vaccine is being developed?
Sure. I think that speed is likely to play into hesitancy on the part of the public about the vaccine. And this is reflected, I think, in some of the polling that's been done recently, looking at the intent of our population to vaccinate. Earlier this month, there was a poll released that showed that only about 66% of Americans intended to vaccinate. And that's not at the level that we think we need to reach that herd immunity threshold. So there's a lot of work that will need to be done to address both that perception as well as the other sources of vaccine hesitancy.
Wow. All right. Well, coming up, we will talk more about vaccine hesitancy, how that works with broader public health goals, and we'll look more at development and allocation of a COVID-19 vaccine, plus more of your emails. Keep them coming in, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Not only are we proud to support NHPR, but the return on our investment seems to be paying off as well.
Corey Snow is co-owner of Monadnock Oil and Vinegar in Peterborough and an underwriter of NHPR.
We chose NHPR partly because I'm a huge listener myself, and the feedback we've been getting since we started supporting NHPR has been fantastic. We're getting more people coming into the store and saying, hey, we heard you while we were listening to the radio the other day.
Learn more about growing your business with NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a COVID-19 vaccine. We're asking what happens once vaccines are developed, what critical decisions are made on how they are deployed, and who gets vaccinated first. Listeners, what questions do you have about how this might all roll out? What are your hopes? What are your fears? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Kendall Hoyt, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine and a lecturer at the Thayer School of Engineering. Also Matthew Fox, Professor of Epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health, and Anne Sawson, Program Director at the Center for Global Health Equity at Dartmouth. Well, all of you, getting back to this issue of vaccine hesitancy that was mentioned before, Matt, first to you, just remind us how this has played into vaccine acceptance and use beforehand and what you're looking at right now.
So this is, the vaccine hesitancy has been around for a while. We all know about the anti-vaxxer groups that do resist the vaccines. It's played itself out in particularly around the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, which there are groups of people who have concerns about it, concerns largely that are have been scientifically shown to be unfounded, but continue to exist. And that has had, unfortunately, consequences in that there have been outbreaks of measles here in the United States for, you know, a disease that was largely eradicated. And so when we think about something like the coronavirus, where the vaccine hesitancy you know, appears to be somewhere in the neighborhoods of 30 to 35% of people have concerns, we know that that's not enough to get us to a point where we could have this disease under control. And so we are really going to have to think very carefully about the public health messaging, about how we encourage people to get a vaccine once it's available, and how we ensure that people are comfortable with a vaccine that, as we said, is going to move at a pace that is much faster than anything that we've ever had before.
At what point, Matt, does that percentage of people rejecting the vaccine diminish or even ruin the protective effects for the public at large?
So it's a bit of a complicated question because we don't know yet how effective that vaccine is going to be. So if what we really need, we think, is about 70% of the population to be effectively vaccinated for the disease to essentially to start to die out. But if we only get 70% of the population who is willing to take that vaccine, but the vaccine itself is only 60% effective rather than 100% effective, then that starts to drop down. But I would still say that that doesn't mean that it isn't worthwhile, because even a less effective vaccine that would allow us to bring the number of cases down to a manageable place where things like testing, isolation, and contact tracing could really have strong impacts on a population level, then that would still be worthwhile. But ideally, what we want is to get those numbers up as high as we can in terms of the proportion of the population that is willing to vaccinate.
Again, Exchange listeners, our number here is 1-800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And once a vaccine is made, this is the big question. I want to hear from everybody on this. Who and how is it decided about who will get it first? Which country, which populations in that country? And I mean, how is that even sorted out?
So there are several committees in place that are thinking now about how vaccines will be allocated, as well as how populations will be prioritized. Here in the U.S., there's a standing committee at the CDC that's looking at prioritization of populations across the country once that vaccine is available. There are also other committees that have been convened to look at that. The starting point for current discussions is a framework that was developed following the H1N1 pandemic, and that was updated just a couple of years ago. But these frameworks need to be updated to reflect the existing evidence and guidance that we have coming out of this particular pandemic. So there's quite a bit of work underway to think about how to manage different considerations, including how to stem the transmission of the disease, but also how to protect those populations that are most vulnerable to the disease and its most severe forms.
Wow. So in this country, Anne, the CDC is sort of making those decisions around once a vaccine that's safe and effective is found, these are the people who go first. Is that right?
So there's ongoing discussion about how this decision will be made, as well as what type of guidance will be provided, because the delivery of the vaccine will happen at state level. So there will be some type of framework or frameworks in place that guides administration.
Wow. What about public trust of the CDC? And if the CDC says, we've looked at the data, this is who seems most vulnerable, these are the people we'd like to go first, is the public going to trust that message?
That's certainly a concern. I think there's a broader concern around mistrust of government in general, but there are also a range of other concerns that we can anticipate as these decisions are made. The other thing to recognize is that there will be a number of other considerations that come into play once we begin to look at distribution and delivery of vaccine. Populations vary from one state to the next as well. And the decisions, just having a document in hand doesn't mean that the vaccine reaches those populations prioritized in it.
Wow. And Kendall, to you on the distribution and sort of production end, what is the role of the private sector in this, the usual market forces of competition and so forth? How do they work in this case, and how do they not work?
Well, it's all through the private sector for the most part. And you know, one of the things we've been looking at here at Dartmouth with a colleague of mine in the economics department, Chris Snyder, we modeled the market for a COVID vaccine and came up with, you know, various scenarios to optimize procurement. And, you know, what you have with, you know, if you, through the free market, which is what we're seeing right now with these bilateral deals, there's limited supply, right? So you're starting to get bidding wars. And what we show is that drives up the cost by a factor of 13.
Wow.
Yeah, which is, you know, irresponsible use of public funds. So and it doesn't need to be that way. And so there are other mechanisms, notably the COVAX vaccine facility, which is a global procurement mechanism that's sort of a collaboration between the WHO, the World Health Organization, Gavi, and CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. And what they've done is they've created sort of an advanced purchase commitment for vaccines. And through that, you can, you know, reduce the cost because you've got a single large buyer. You can reduce the risk because you have a broader portfolio. So you improve your overall probability of producing a handful of successful candidates. You can improve coordination because, as I said, you know, this is a highly globalized process. So if you're allowing the free market to dominate and countries are competing against one another, they can, you know, exert protectionist measures, which will snarl supply chains and hamper development for everybody. And you can improve access, right? So it's now not just which country can pay the most, but you've acquired this vaccine through a global mechanism. So you can allocate the vaccine on a needs basis. So you can really target the most vulnerable populations first to end chains of transmission more quickly than you would under a regular free market scenario. So it is, you're working through the private market, but there are ways to procure it to sort of align corporate interests with public health goals.
Wow. You mentioned Gavi, Kendall. What is Gavi?
Yeah, so Gavi is, you know, the Vaccine Alliance, and they work with governments and companies around the world to do this, essentially, to pool demand and to reduce cost of vaccines so you can really increase access to life-saving vaccines. And they tend to do it for, you know, low-income countries, but in this case, we'd be talking about doing it for everybody.
How optimistic are you, Kendall, that this scenario that you just presented, where there is global sharing, basically, and some breaks on the profit motive for private developers of a vaccine, how optimistic are you that this scenario will come to pass?
Well, there are a number of countries that have expressed interest in cooperating with this mechanism, a good number. And so it'll be really interesting to see by the end of this month in August, they have to start to commit to providing the funds that would allow for this purchase fund to operate as designed. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I am cautiously hopeful that it will operate on some scale, maybe not on the maximum scale desired, but you know, as a proof, I think we'll be able to show that this works as a concept. And over time, you know, I'm hoping that higher income countries will see this as an important addition to their in-country strategies. You know, they could contribute to the fund almost as a form of insurance, right? Because they're reducing their risk. You know, the US can only invest in 5 or 6 vaccines through these bilateral deals, but COVAX already has a portfolio of about 10, and they could double that. And so, you know, by participating in COVAX, you get it's an insurance policy. Some vaccine through COVAX is better than no vaccine at all in the event that you get locked into some unsuccessful candidates. So my hope is, you know, over time, more and more countries will see the value of this mechanism.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us as we talk about development and distribution of possible COVID-19 vaccines. And I say vaccines because there are a lot in development right now. What questions do you have about how this will all roll out? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And what do you think about this scenario that Kendall just described for us? You know, it goes against what we often see, which is competition among companies and competition among countries. What do you think, Anne?
You know, I'm deeply concerned about how this is going to play out globally. We have had a lot of conversation in this country about some of the inequities revealed by the pandemic, but there's been much less discussion around the global inequities that have been revealed by that. We in our work are already seeing low and middle income countries being left behind in the global arms race for PPE, diagnostics, and other essential supplies. And I think we can anticipate that to play out around global access to vaccines as well. I think that there's global momentum to put the mechanisms in place to get vaccines to countries out to low and middle income countries, but there's going to need to be quite a bit of work to actually ensure that that happens. I think there's a risk here that we end the epidemic in the US and other high income settings, but then we have a pandemic raging out of control in many of the world's poorest countries. And that, you know, and that will set us back very far on other gains that have been made in those settings in recent years.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, Anne, ending the pandemic, you know, air quotes, in the U.S., if it isn't ended in other countries, there's a distinct possibility, right, that it will just come back over here. I mean, this is a global pandemic and it's spread globally.
Certainly, if we don't end it everywhere, we're going to continue to be at risk here in this country. And I think there are recent examples that we can cite to show the danger of thinking that we're not vulnerable to infectious disease threats in other settings. With the recent Ebola outbreak in West Africa being one of the most notable ones.
Yeah. So basically, Anne, if the pandemic is over, the pandemic basically won't be over in any one country until it is over globally. Or am I oversimplifying it there?
Exactly.
Matt, got to get your thoughts on this, too. It's really interesting. Just this idea of stamping this thing out globally requires global sharing, global cooperation, not something that the world usually does, Matt.
It's not something that we're great at, particularly with the differences in power between nations and the scramble for countries to really want to protect themselves, because it has implications not only for health, but also for the economy. And so countries are going to push very hard. And that's why these initiatives like Gavi are so important. Just to go back to the point that Anne raised, I mean, I do think that if we have a vaccine, but that vaccine is not 100% effective and you have vaccine hesitancy, there will continue to be pockets of the even highly vaccinated countries where people are continuing to be susceptible to the infection. And once, as you say, people come in from other countries where vaccination is low because we didn't do a good job of global distribution, that will continue to seed outbreaks here, even in those countries where there is high vaccination. So we really need to think about a vaccination strategy that targets those who are most at risk for transmission in order to be able to get the epidemic under control.
Wow. So you're looking at two fronts, Matt. One is vaccine hesitancy here in the U.S. and how that affects effectiveness of vaccines. But you're also looking globally at how many countries are able to participate in this.
I think that's absolutely right. I think we cannot think of ourselves as an isolated country, and I think no country can. We have to think about what's going on in the rest of the world, because ultimately it's going to affect us.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and we welcome your questions and comments. Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, once an effective COVID-19 vaccine is developed, then what? That's what we're asking today on The Exchange. We're looking at distribution and manufacturing of a vaccine and all the complexities that are involved in scaling this up to such a large scale for the whole world. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call in, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking this hour with Kendall Hoyt, an assistant professor of medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, also a lecturer at the Thayer School of Engineering. Also Matthew Fox, professor of epidemiologist at Boston University School of Public Health, and Anne Sawson, program director for the Center for Global Health Equity at Dartmouth College. And here's an email from Fred who says, does the U.S. under Trump participate in global planning for the manufacture and distribution of the vaccine? And Kendall, I'll throw that to you first, please.
No.
So we're not participating in any of these global efforts that you all mentioned earlier?
No, not to say that we won't in the future.
So what does that mean for Americans who are also yearning for a vaccine and some freedom from this pandemic?
Well, in the U.S., we have invested in Operation Warp Speed, which is not an insignificant effort, close to $10 billion with investing in 6 different candidates. And that is one of the more ambitious nation-based programs, around the world. But it's risky, right? I think when you look at probabilities of success, some of the research shows that once a vaccine enters human trials, you've got a 17% chance of success. So, if you're investing in 6 vaccines, there's maybe, a 67% chance that one or more will succeed. But if you're COVAX and you're investing in 10 or 20, you have a much greater chance of getting a vaccine. The other, one potential problem with the U.S. approach too is that when you look at what we're investing in, there are different vaccine platforms. They're like 5 basic kinds of vaccine, and we're investing in 3 of the 5. So we maybe haven't diversified some of the technological risk as much as we would or should. That's a bit of an issue. And some of the technological platforms are new and untested, like nucleic acid vaccines. We have not licensed one of those before or manufactured one of those before at scale. So it is a little risky.
Oh, that's interesting. Matt, can you address just this idea of it's important to have a portfolio of approaches when it comes to a vaccine? Not all vaccines work the same way, and it's better to have sort of more irons in the fire, so to speak. Matt, go ahead.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think Kendall raised the point that the more of these vaccines, the higher the probability is that one of them will be successful. But at the same time, we don't know which ones are likely to be effective. And we also are trying out methodologies for the vaccines that we've never been successful with before, which brings with it a whole new level of risk in terms of success. So the idea is that we want to have as many possibilities, as many shots as this as we can, because there are so many that are currently being tested and are being trialed. I think that is why there is such optimism that one of these different approaches will in fact turn out to be effective. But until that actually happens, we don't know. And so we want to be pursuing as many of these different approaches as we possibly can.
What kind of timelines are you looking at, Matt? When might these vaccines be available to, you know, me and my family?
So we're hearing from, you know, the most trusted sources that we have on this, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's saying that he is optimistic that we could start seeing a vaccine by the end of this year, early into next year. It's not clear to me, though, that that means that a vaccine that would be effective would necessarily be able to be scaled up and rolled out. And so that's going to take another, you know, potentially 6 months to really get to the point at which we could be seeing effective rollout of these vaccines. So I'm cautiously optimistic that something early next year is going to be found to be effective, but the amount of time that it's going to take for that to be scaled up is going to take, you know, a substantially longer time frame.
Wow, 6 months. So if there's a great announcement on New Year's Day, Matt, that there's this great vaccine and it works and it's effective, it's June before we are able to all get access to this thing?
So when I say that, I'm really talking about large scale rollouts. So
sure.
I think that you would start to scale up, obviously, immediately. And as I mentioned, there are already processes in place to scale that up. But to get to the point at which we had enough to be able to really be looking at effective population level immunity, it's gonna take a substantial amount of time.
Wow. Okay. Thanks for the news on a Monday morning, Matt, but I appreciate what you're saying and giving us a reality check that this does take time. And towards your expertise, as this starts to roll out, and as Matt is reminding us, it's not instant, what would you like to see to ensure more equitable distribution? We talked earlier about how, you know, equity is important because everybody's in this together. Go ahead, Anne.
Sure. I think that there's a couple of things that need to be in place to ensure equity in access to vaccines. The first is that we need to have a clear framework in place that defines priority populations in an equitable way. But then once we have that framework in place, we need to look at the systems that are needed to deliver that vaccine and address a range of concerns around equity. In terms of how populations are able to access a vaccine and put in place measures to overcome some of those barriers. And then we really need to think about how do we partner with communities where there are likely going to be challenges in terms of access and uptake of the vaccine, and really design strategies both around messaging and around access.
Yeah, and again, uptake means people who are willing to do it. Is that right, Anne?
Right.
Yeah. And who's going to pay for this, Anne? I mean, our government's just going to say, look, this is in our national interest to get everybody vaccinated. We want the economy to open. We want kids to be back in school. We'll pay for it, or are Americans going to have to shell out, you know, $25, $50, $75 for this thing?
So this is obviously part of the process of delivering a vaccine. And so we can expect that private insurers will probably pay for vaccine for many Americans, but then there needs to be a strategy in place to ensure that those who don't have insurance coverage are able to access a vaccine as well. So that's part of the planning that's happening in the background as the vaccine is being developed. And when we talk about barriers, financial barriers is one of those barriers that we need to be mindful of when we think about equity.
Kendall, to the question I asked Matt a moment ago about timeframes, what kind of timeframes are you looking at given your expertise in production and scale up and distribution?
Yeah, I agree with what Matt said, that there will be, you know, we're likely to have positive efficacy results from, you know, one of these candidates by the end of the year. The real question is what happens next?
Right.
And there's so much that goes into that. So as he said, you know, you need 70% coverage for herd immunity. Let's say that the vaccine requires two doses, then you're talking about 462 million doses for the US. And that's a huge scale up problem. So that you've got capacity issues, you know, which we already discussed. You've got quality control. So, you know, once you start manufacturing a vaccine, it's not like making, you know, a regular old widget. You know, you have to develop and license the process. So there's like a license for the facility, you know, that produces the vaccine. You have to assure purity and safety and consistency in the way you're doing it. Then you need to like package it in vials and syringes. And, you know, during the H1N1 pandemic, that was a rate limiting step. We learned we didn't have enough what's called fill finish facilities. Then you've got, you know, supply chains, which are stretched past capacity for all of these key ingredients and supplies. And then you've got, you know, distribution and administration. What Anne said, you need to set up all of these centers to administer the vaccine in the right place. So there are, you know, there's a lot that goes into that chain once you get the positive efficacy results, all of which have potential choke points. You know, so this is, if everything goes right, then you might look at sufficient scale out 6 months from that point.
Wow. I wonder, you know, we talked about the ingredients needed to make the vaccine and licensing requirements for the manufacturing. What about the workforce, Kendall, the trained workers who will know how to do this and do it safely? You don't want somebody mucking up.
Right. Yeah, no, we have a pretty good trained workforce. Have they operated at this scale before? No.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah. Sure.
Right. Yeah. So that's an issue.
Do we have enough Americans, at least speaking in this country, who know how to do this? So that's going to be a workforce
that's something
issue.
We should have. We will invest in going forward.
Here's an email from Glenn who says, what is the possibility that an existing vaccine for another illness could be affected for COVID-19? Glenn, thank you. And Matt, what do you know about that?
Well, we don't have great evidence to suggest that this is true. There are some, there was some early evidence that some of the vaccines that have been used for tuberculosis they're not used in the United States, but it's used in other countries, might have some general immune system benefits that might be helpful. But we haven't actually seen any really good evidence to back that up. And so we just don't have really good evidence to suggest at the moment that there are any other vaccines that we're currently using that would be, you know, highly effective in terms of preventing coronavirus infection.
Is that a typical early strategy when these diseases break out, Matt, to look first at what has worked before with other illnesses? It seems to make sense.
Well, certainly if there's anything that we had that was could potentially provide some, immunity to a novel virus, we would want to be using that first. But the issue there is that if there were anything that currently existed, you know, those would be vaccines that we are already using in large scale already, and most people would already be vaccinated and therefore theoretically protective or have some level of protection. We just haven't seen anything to suggest that that is the case.
Wow. Well, last questions for all of you. And to you first, what's going to be your main focus, Anne, as these vaccines do come closer to production?
So I think that there are two things. One is thinking about the inherent equity questions that are going to emerge around vaccine and reaching our most vulnerable populations. But then the second thing for me is thinking about what's our strategy to sustain us between now and the point at which we have a vaccine. I don't think we've articulated a very clear strategy to get from here to that point. And we're going to need to do that because it's going to take us quite a long time before we have vaccination at the levels that we need.
Oh, so you're talking about that interim point, that sort of between January and June point, Anne, is that what you're saying?
I think that point is between now and then. And this is a particular challenge, I think, in our region, given that we have really low numbers of cases, but we need, we're going to need to sustain the efforts we have in place to be able to reach that point at which we're vaccinated. And that's not a challenge that we've had to undertake before.
Wow. Anne, it's been really interesting to talk to you. I hope you join us again. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Anne Sossen, Program Director for the Center for Global Health Equity at Dartmouth. Kendall Hoyt, how about you? What are you going to be looking at primarily as this process moves forward?
So my greatest hope for all of this is that we can really start to produce, you know, develop faith in and refine some of the tools that will allow us to produce vaccines as global public goods, not as commodities, you know, especially for pandemics. And, you know, I would say, you know, it's like greenhouse gas emissions. These viral spillover events are transnational issues, and no one country can solve it alone. So I think the challenge for us right now and going forward is, how do we develop the institutions and the tools that will allow nations to address these problems collectively, efficiently, and quickly? So, you know, the good news is that we already, a lot of these tools exist. You know, Gavi and CEPI and the WHO have been working on this for a long time, and they're pulling together things like COVAX in record time. And, you know, what we need to do is see their value and invest in them and refine this.
Well, Kendall, thank you. And I hope we can check back it again with you at a later date. It's been really interesting to talk to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Kendall Hoyt, an assistant professor of medicine at Dartmouth Geisel School of Medicine. Matthew Fox, I hope to talk to you again. I really appreciate you being with us today as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Matthew Fox, professor of epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Senior producers Ellen Grimm, and the producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.